This morning on Sesame Street, the number of the day is...
40!
That's a huge number! How many is 40?
It takes some explaining, but I can say that 40 years ago today, Sesame Street aired its first episode. The last 4,186 shows have taught kids their numbers and letters. But we wanted to find out what lessons the producers and performers on Sesame Street have learned. So we sent NPR's Robert Smith out to the neighborhood.
Sesame Street was always considered an experiment. The first show opened in 1969 with this space-age synthesizer music and a question. Could kids actually learn anything from a television set?
The one thing about Sesame Street that hasn't changed in 40 years is that we still call it an experiment in children's television.
Carolyn Parenti is the executive producer of Sesame Street.
Sunny day, sleeping up, clouds away.
This year, producers once again added new characters, rearranged the show, and jazzed up that theme. Parenti says numbers and letters never change, but getting kids to learn them takes constant tweaking. So, what has the Sesame Street team learned? Let's count.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Lesson number
one.
Children are much more adaptable than once thought. Originally, the monsters were not going to interact with humans on Sesame Street.
At the time, educators were concerned that if... in fact, you were on the street with human characters and trying to teach something, and Muppets appeared, there would be a mix-up between what was considered to be fantasy and reality, and the children would have difficulty adjusting to that.
Louise Gicko wrote the new book, Sesame Street, 40 Years of Life on the Street. She says that when they test-marketed the show, they found the exact opposite. Kids paid more attention when the Muppets talked. Which brings us to lesson number...
two!
A good Muppet character takes time to grow.
I'm Carol Spinney. For 40 years, I've been playing Big Bird.
Hello.
And Oscar the Grouch.
Get away from me.
And he's never liked me, Oscar.
There's a sweetness to the Muppets now. So it's hard to believe that in the beginning, they felt raw, even scary. Oscar seemed meaner. Big Bird was a big dope.
Hell, Gordon. He talked like that the first show.
The key for all the Muppets was finding that human character inside. Spinney's realization was that Big Bird wasn't stupid. He was a six-year-old.
He's sort of a surrogate child. He learned the alphabet along with the kids at home.
And as for Oscar, that's lesson number...
three.
Oscar was orange in the first season. Cookie Monster once had teeth. If a character feels real, then kids can accept the changes. Speaking of Cookie, let's have him help with lesson number...
four.
Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that start with C.
How about the word competition?
I love you.
Let's go!
Dora, 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 the Explorer!
SpongeBob SquarePants!
It was getting crowded in children's TV. Sesame Street had to adapt.
Yo, MC Elmo got something to say about the Sesame number 40 today. It's the number we're pitching in, that's no jive. It's cool, it's hip, it's fresh and fun!
Lesson five, freshen up. Elmo played a big part in brightening Sesame Street. But another change could be seen on the street itself.
I've lived 40 years in this lovely, classy part of the neighborhood.
Carol Spinney shows me around the set. It still has that urban New York vibe. But back when I watched the program, the street was darker. There was graffiti, and you could hear these cars rushing by. Looking at the early episodes, the current set looks so much cleaner. It looks like they cleaned up the neighborhood a little bit.
It looked more grungy. Frankly, I loved it grungy.
Well, much like the city of New York, it's been gentrified a little bit, cleaned
yes,
up.
Yes, yes. I think the whole country has come up that way.
But Spinney promises me Oscar will never be moved to a recycling bin. Of course, Sesame Street has made mistakes before. Now, where were we in that count of lessons learned by Sesame Street over the last 40 years?
I'm six years old today.
Yay! Yes, six. Learning from mistakes. In 1994, Sesame Street sprawled. They built a new part of the neighborhood around the corner from the old street and added tons of new characters and Ruth Buzzy.
Today, we're going to cook up one of my favorite things in the whole wide world,
the number six.
But author Louise Gicko says it was too confusing.
So they pulled back on the characters and went back to the street.
Sesame Street was learning to keep it simple.
Seven! Seven cookies!
At the number seven slot, a lesson about children.
They love a narrative.
Rosemary Trulio is in charge of research at Sesame Street. She says the early show is modeled after fast-paced variety shows like Laugh-In. But kids, with their VCRs and DVDs, were developing a longer attention span.
And we were breaking up the narrative in these little skits and interrupting it with the lessons about letters and numbers and sharing and brushing your teeth instead of having the children experience the narrative as a 15-minute story.
These days, Sesame Street has a more regimented pace. There's a long story out on the street, then mini-shows. Ernie and Bert get their 10 minutes, Elmo gets his 15. Turns out it's calm and predictable for the younger audience that Sesame Street is drawing these days. No more getting distracted by a chef on a staircase.
Hey, raspberry pudding, dessert.
And our last lesson, number eight, pushing the envelope. This season, Ernie and Bert are presented in claymation. The fairy, Abby Cadabby, is computer-generated.
Let's go in. Let's begin. It's flying fairies.
It is downright shocking for parents who grew up with the real furry puppets, who want the new Sesame Street to be like the one they watched. But researchers say that children barely notice. The characters are real to them, whatever the format. And perhaps that can be our bonus lesson from the 40-year experiment called Sesame Street. The children are always right. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Renee's back with us tomorrow. I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The Gossip Girl TV show on the CW network is known for pushing envelopes. The show, which is based on the popular books of the same name, follows the lives, really mainly the love lives, of rich kids in Manhattan's Upper East Side. Well, this week, they not only pushed the boundaries of good taste, they also pushed a lot of parents' hot buttons with a much-hyped episode that featured a menage a trois. Well, it's no surprise that the plotline has drawn protests, but some parents are taking a much more nuanced approach. Instead of banning the program, they're using it as a teachable moment or a barometer of their kids' attitudes. Liz Pearly falls into that camp. She's the co-founder of Common Sense Media. The group's stated mission is to look for sanity and not censorship. And Liz Pearly joins me now. Welcome to the program.
It's a delight to be here.
Now, I understand that you have a 19-year-old daughter and a 16-year-old son, and that you tried to steer your son away from last night's controversial episode.
I sure did, actually. It's many conversations that I like to have with my son, and I use Gossip Girl, actually, to get to some of the ones he won't talk about on his own. But frankly, I said, there's a Warriors game on, and then you can do your homework, because one conversation I wasn't ready to have with him was about a ménage à trois.
For the listeners who didn't watch the show last night, a little bit more about this. The young people on Gossip Girl were focused on a list of the things to do in college before you graduate, and a threesome is the last item on that list, and here's where they admit whether or not they've had one. Let's take a quick listen.
You ever?
Have I? No. No. No, never. Wait. No. Never. Have you?
Once. But it was in a movie, so that doesn't really count.
Not me, no.
Okay, one of them said it was in the movies because she's an actress, and there's a lot of what you don't see there, batting of eyelashes and coquettish tilting of the heads, and they eventually do what they were talking about doing. Is this the kind of thing that makes you squirm?
As a mother and as a professional parent at Common Sense Media, it certainly gets my attention, yes, because they're positioning this as a absolutely normal, must-do kind of thing, and they're positioning it to my kid who's actually starting to think about college. So those two things get twinned in his mind, and I'm going to have to pull the strands apart.
So what's the dilemma there? How do you handle something like this, if this is, as you say, a teachable moment?
Well, you know, One of the things that we try and do at Common Sense is teach our kids to see, because we can't cover their eyes. And there are right times and right places for right introductions of right conversations. I'm not sure this was one I was ready to have, but we did talk about it in the car this morning. And I said, so you missed a good episode last night. And he said, well, I actually heard about it on Facebook from somebody.
Does the network here, the CW network, have parents in a bit of a trap? The more that parents protest, the more it can just drive up the ratings.
You know, it's one of the things I did talk about with my son this morning was this is pretty desperate attempt just to get ratings. And we used it as a moment to sort of talk about how the industry works, which is look at how hard they have to scream at you to get you to turn in.
Did your son know what a ménage à trois was before this episode? Pardon me if I ask.
You know, he did, and I have no idea how. It was one of those, okay then, so how do you know that kind of conversation? And it was, oh, Mom. So, I mean, these kids are growing up in such a sexualized environment that it's almost imperative for parents to get to their world and get into it and talk about it and see what sense they're making out of it all.
Thank you, Ms. Burley.
You're welcome.
That was Liz Perley. She's the co-founder of Common Sense Media.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In an otherwise bleak season for sitcoms, Ugly Betty has been one of the few scripted network television hits in the last few years. The show is a campy, over-the-top comedy. It's much like a soap opera that revolves around life at a glossy fashion magazine. And it has won a loyal fan base, in part due to its matter-of-fact portrayal of gay characters. And one of those characters is Mark St. James, the outrageously sycophantic personal assistant to fashionista editor Wilhelmina Slater, played by Vanessa Williams.
She wants to sell a vintage couture gown that Jackie Kennedy wore at the White House?
I know, so stupid. You can't just secretly auction off a vintage dress. She's never going to sell it, that's what I say.
She'll have a buyer in 10 minutes. It's genius.
Exactly, her plan is perfect.
You know what we have to do, Mark?
Bid on it? And then take turns wearing it.
No, sweetheart, not this time.
Oh.
You get a feel for the relationship between assistant and editor listening to that clip. The assistant, Mark St. James, is played by the actor Michael Urie. And Michael Urie joins me now from NPR Studios in Manhattan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Hello, Michelle.
Now, I understand that your character was supposed to be just a cameo.
Yeah.
And Vanessa Williams was supposed to get a revolving slate of assistants.
Exactly.
Just one of them was supposed to be you, but you wound up staying. How'd that happen?
Well, because Vanessa Williams liked me. She included me in bits. She said, stand closer to me, which in TV is everything, because if you're closer to the star, then you might be in the shot. She gave lines to me. She just helped me get a spot on the show.
One of the things I'm curious about is how much of a role you had in creating your own character, because you weren't supposed to be there in the first place. So they sort of created your character on the fly. How involved were you with that?
It's definitely been a collaboration, because I'm only as funny as my timing, and timing is so much in the editing in television. On stage, you have an audience and you have other actors, and timing is different. But in TV, it's created later. You can get the punchline badly four times in a row, but they can put it in the right spot so that it's still funny. So anyway, maybe I just gave them too much credit. I definitely, for me as an actor, I'm not the kind of let's just rewind a bit and go before Ugly Betty. I would go out for parts on TV shows where the description for the character would be half a page, and it would be he's a tough-as-nails cop with a heart of gold, and whenever he gets two drinks in and blah, blah. And it's like the odds of me, Michael Urie, fitting what they have already come up with, it's not too high. And so, like, whenever a role comes along where it says, Mark, Wilhelmina's bitchy gay assistant, and that's it, it gives someone like me a chance, because they don't know what the hell they want. All they want is for him to be bitchy, gay, and an assistant. And I might get the part. And so that's sort of like the stuff I look for, is the stuff that they haven't really thought out yet. Because if they've thought about it, it's probably not going to be me.
Now, as evil and as scheming and as over the top as your character can be, there's one soft spot that he seems to have. He's played a mentoring role over the course of the series to Betty Suarez's teenage nephew, Justin, who at least seems to be gay, but no one ever says that. The family just goes as far as to say he's mighty festive, but they never really talk about his sexual orientation.
Yeah.
He's a very flamboyant teenage kid, and he's into fashion and dancing. And your character, Mark, sometimes offers Justin advice. He tells him, for instance, to learn how to run really fast. And he even stands up for Justin when he's confronting his own mother. And your mother on the show is played by Patti LuPone. And maybe before we go on, we should take a quick listen to this.
He's just so swishy. The mother doesn't say anything. It just makes me sick.
Okay, shut your mouth, Mom.
What did you say to me?
You don't get to talk about these people like that. And that little boy, swishy, swishy. You want to talk about swishy? Open your eyes, Mom, and look at your own swishy son.
I imagine you sometimes think about what it would be like for you as a young man to watch a show like this when you were a teenager. When you film these scenes, do you imagine what young kids struggling with their own sexuality are going through or thinking of when they're sitting at home watching this show?
Absolutely. There is, one of the things about having specifically Justin, I mean, they've had funny gay guys on TV before. So I'm nothing new. But the relationship between Justin and Mark is something new. And Justin is something new. Having a character like that is a new thing, and it's a whole new class of people that have never seen themselves on TV before. And then now to watch what's happening with Justin's character and how supportive his mother and grandfather and aunt are with him, it's a really beautiful example of how people across this country could deal with a situation that is maybe outside their comfort zone.
Now, the relationship between Mark St. James and the teenager Justin deepens this week when Justin gets into trouble with some bullies. Mm-hmm. And as we said, Ugly Betty is a comedy, but this is serious stuff. What's the objective here? Are you trying to speak not just to those who are bullied, but those who are doing the bullying?
I think for sure it's not painted as a nice example, certainly. And the bullies certainly get theirs in the end. Justin is not happy about being in public school anyway because he wanted to go to performing arts school and he didn't get in. So Mark's advice is to befriend the cheerleaders because the cheerleaders are the mean girls. The mean girls lead to popularity. And if he's with them, he won't get messed with. And so that's what he does. In a way, it does help him. He becomes more popular. But in a way, it also shines a light on the things that the bullies were bullying. The kid that they've written is very smart. And I think a lot of that comes from having smart people around him. His family, they're smart. They handle things correct. They talk about problems. They treat people right. And I think that Justin is a kid who does that. And so he handles it well.
I'm wondering if this is the way of the future when gay characters are more of the tapestry of a storyline instead of being sort of introduced and trumpeted when they are a part of the storyline, almost as, if the producers are seeking a gold star for having diversity of character as opposed to just sort of making them part of the cast.
Right. And they're not just a joke anymore. It's not used as a punchline. They deliver the punchlines, but they are not the punchline.
But you often are the punchline.
Yes, but not for being gay, for being silly. We don't make gay jokes on the show. We sometimes have funny things that happen, and they are stereotypically done by gay people normally, but it's not like blah, 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 and you're gay, and that's the joke. They're smarter than that. And we're not catering to an audience who thinks jokes like that are funny.
Michael Urey, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That was Michael Urey. He's the actor who plays a character called Mark St. James on the TV show Ugly Betty. To see Urey in a sneak preview of tomorrow's episode of Ugly Betty, go to npr.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. CNN's Lou Dobbs was one of the original anchors when the cable news network started nearly three decades ago. Since then, he has transitioned from a host of a nightly business broadcast to populist firebrand. Yesterday evening, he told viewers of Lou Dobbs Tonight he was leaving the show immediately.
Some leaders in media, politics, and business have been urging me to go beyond the role here at CNN and to engage in constructive problem solving, as well as to contribute positively to a better understanding of the great issues of our day.
For more on Lou Dobbs' departure, we turn to NPR's David Folkenflik, who's in our New York bureau. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, you can sort out what we just heard, because I'm not absolutely clear what that is. What is the story?
Well, it kind of goes down to this. You know, the self-styled Mr. Independent, as Mr. Dobbs calls himself each night on CNN, or has become something of a sharp ideologue in recent years. He said he was kind of radicalized by 9/11, and particularly barbed on economic issues and especially on immigration and a lot of issues that affect Latinos. You often heard his rhetoric would blur the lines between legal and illegal immigrants, and then again between illegal immigrants and those illegal immigrants who committed other explicit criminal acts. And let me give you one example. In attacking President Obama earlier this year, here he is criticizing the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Effectively, an organization that is interested in the export of American capital and production to Mexico and Mexico's export of drugs and illegal aliens to the United States.
Now, he had to apologize for that, but he said it twice during that particular show. And the severe tone there is pretty indicative of the kind of remarks he would fairly frequently make. He was even rougher in a lot of the things he'd say on his syndicated national radio show, often distorting or getting incorrect certain kinds of things. In one episode, I remember, he cited figures for leprosy that he was blaming on illegal immigrants. These figures were wildly inaccurate. And he forced his staff in reporting on that on a quest for sources that NPR and other news organizations showed to be utterly unqualified. It led to a lot of groups representing Latinos and others to call for boycotts of advertisers on his show.
Still, David, there are plenty of ideological figures on cable news. Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck of Fox on the right, Rachel Maddow, Keith Olbermann of MSNBC on the left. I mean, why is this different in that he's leaving the show now?
Well, you got to think about CNN. It's being badly beaten in the ratings. As you say, Fox has turned right with its punditry. Some would also say its story selection. MSNBC left. CNN says, hey, look, we're the guys doing it down the middle, the objective reporters. And Dobbs undermines that in two pretty key ways, both as an ideologue and also as somebody presenting inaccurate or distortive reporting. For example, he indulged earlier this year the so-called birthers who tried to cast doubt on President Obama and his citizenship and right to hold office. Here's the kind of language you would have heard on Dobbs' radio and TV shows this past summer.
And seemingly the questions won't go away because they haven't been dealt with. All he has to do is just produce the original birth certificate in Hawaii.
I don't know what the reality is. Do I believe he's a citizen? Yes, I do. Absolutely.
This greatly upset CNN executives. He was cautioned. They said, you can say what you want on the radio show. Do not do this on television. And in fact, on one night when he was taking the day off with a substitute anchor, CNN ran a lengthy corrective story, essentially disproving any doubt about President Obama's citizenship. Dobbs returned to the show and soon said, hey, you know, it's legitimate to question this. There are legitimate doubts. This led to months of tensions. And in the meantime, even as CNN's ratings down, so were his own.
So Lou Dobbs Tonight, well, the show, at least Lou Dobbs is leaving the show. What's next for him and what's next for CNN?
Well, he's gone immediately. You know, Dobbs still has the radio show. He says he'll be in the public eye. There's been past speculation that he'd be a perfect choice for Fox Business News or Fox News Channel. Fox spokeswoman denies, for both channels, denies any contact. Meanwhile, CNN says, look, he's gone. It'll be naming a new anchor very shortly. It's cleaned up its brand, saying, you know, we're the ones who operate independent journalism shorn of ideology. Its only challenge now is to draw those missing hundreds of thousands or millions of viewers back into the fold.
David, thanks very much.
You bet.
NPR's David Folkenflik speaking to us from New York.